What I want to share now with you is what is the Ecuadorian experience about not exactly oral traditions, but all the idea of orality and orality in relation to education, but also in something that was addressed in the last presentation, which is cultural heritage or intangible cultural heritage. Well, first, a brief view about Ecuador's languages. We are a small country, but I think we are very diverse, linguistically speaking. There are 13 different indigenous languages in Ecuador, 4 in the Pacific lowlands, 1 in the Andean highlands, which is the largest, is Quechua, or Quechua properly, 8 in the Amazon lowlands. The population of indigenous speakers is a matter of debate, but I would say it's about above two million speakers. Quechua and Shuar speakers of Quechua and Shuar represent over the 75%. About the vitality, while all of these languages are in danger, some are more critically so, and perhaps the worst case in this is the case of the Zaparo language, which was declared as in 2001 a masterpiece. The Zaparo oral tradition was declared. It was one of the first to be declared masterpieces by UNESCO. The official language is Spanish, and Quechua and Shuar, according to the last constitution, are also official languages of intercultural communication. This is the distribution of Quechua. Quechua, as you can see, is in the very center of the Andes, but also in the Amazon. In fact, speakers of indigenous languages in the Amazon are bilingual in Quechua and their own native languages. This is a map of the Indian nations. Thank you. Of the Indian nations and the associated languages. As you can see, the most diverse area is the Amazon. Okay. So, since 1989. Indigenous languages have what is called a program of intercultural bilingual education. And this program provides elementary school children with education in Spanish and their own native languages. This program is seen by indigenous people as the result of their century-long struggle for their education rights, and the result also of their political empowerment, as they call it. And they have really made good use of several legal frameworks within the nation state just to claim their rights to education, to bilingual education, and many other related rights. So I will go over this because it's very important to understand how this works. The Indian movement became stronger and stronger during the 1980s, and these two results were empowerment and ethnic resurgence. So that's something very different from other neighboring countries, like, for instance, Peru and Colombia, or even Brazil. The power, the political power of the Indian movement in Ecuador is incredible. They have how is that word? Outstead governments. For instance, in 2001, that's one case, and also in 2004. So they are very powerful, politically speaking, but also they have tried to set their own political agendas to the government, and along these lines they want to work on different issues. So the result of this empowerment and ethnic resurgence is intercultural education program, and it results in the reinforcement of their linguistic identity. All this is developed within the framework of the nation state. But somehow, the indigenous movement wants to create different nations within the nation state. So that's that's a very important thing. So, in fact, there are today 13 Indian nations, what's called in Ecuador, Indian nations, and different peoples, Indian peoples. So this is very important to understand the Indian movement and also the context of intercultural bilingual education. As you can see, the linguistic identity is reinforced by the Indian movement, but also reinforces the power of the Indian movement. Some facts after 20 years of intercultural bilingual education are not, the facts, I mean the results are not very, very good, I would say. Retention and dropout rates keep high. Teaching materials are available only for some languages, especially for the biggest, like Quechua and Shuar. Teaching materials, when they are available, are not generally used by teachers. There is no standardized methodology for IBE. There is poor training of teachers in IBE methodology. And native language, the native languages, the indigenous languages, are not usually written outside the schools. All this means that, in a sense, these languages remain anchored in orality. In fact, they have not passed to the literacy scheme. So, this was, of course, seen by the Indian movement, by different government and non-government organizations, and they realized that there is an urgent need to find alternative ways to make intercultural bilingual education more practical and more attractive, both to teachers and children. One of these, of course, there are many ideas. But one of the ones that was put in practice was the Quechua Lab, the Quechua Laboratory. It was launched as a pilot project in bilingual education in 2008 and installed as part of the Millennium Schools. These Millennium Schools are located in impoverished areas of the country. And what is interesting is that they make use of a tremendous high technology. So you don't have only computers, but also digital whiteboards, and well, everything is so good. The problem is that sometimes locals have not been properly trained in the use of this, all these tools. So it's sometimes these tools become kaput after some months of use. So they wanted to the Quechua Lab was thought to provide an educational and recreational space for school children to learn and use native languages. And also the idea was to bring school children of indigenous background closer to ICTs. That was very important also, because people usually over 30 years old, they are not well trained, they cannot even make use of computers, but usually younger people, younger generations, they know how to do it and they feel attracted to ICTs. So that was an advantage to for the Quechua lab. But also, the idea was to provide teachers several tools for producing and teaching indigenous languages. And all this was accompanied by their training in the basics of linguistics. So that was one of the initiatives launched in 2008. But also since 2008, there has been another development related to indigenous languages and orality. And that has to do with intangible cultural heritage. Nowadays, a draft of a new law of cultures is being discussed at the Ecuadorian Congress. And a very important part of this law is the status given to indigenous languages as part of the nation's cultural heritage. So also there is a very important institution in this case, the National Heritage Institute, INPC, which has recently launched several programs intended to the safeguarding of intangible cultural heritage and of languages as a central part of it. And the National Heritage Institute is working with UNESCO since 2003. However, we have seen that the concept of heritage is, first of all, not unambiguous, but is construed and applied at different levels of social organization. You can talk about heritage at a world level, at a nation-state level, at an ethnic group level, and each level follows a different approach. And each of these approaches is sustained by different political stances and interests. So it's not as easy as people from UNESCO might think, or even other institutions in Ecuador might think. The idea of heritage is, in its very conception, in its very inception, a political one. See? So, the problem here is that when the state tries to promote the idea of heritage and cultural heritage and the languages as a very important part of it, this idea is not easily and clearly appropriated by ethnic groups. So that's one of the reasons why they do not actively participate in the safeguarding programs intended for that. So this is a very important thing to take into account. Accordingly, linguists, I think, should be, not only linguists, but any scholar and also bureaucrats working with cultural heritage should be sensitive to a speaker's perceptions of their own languages. And as I said before, in Ecuador's case, this perception is essentially ethnical and political. And usually disregards concerns of science, like human knowledge, human mind, or even concerns about diversity, the richness of culture, multiculturalism as promoted by the state, or even revitalization. The idea of heritage for the Indian movement and for Indian nations in Ecuador is closely related to their political claims before the state. So it's not only a matter of science, diversity, or revitalization. The first idea they have when they talk about heritage is a political claiming of their rights. So the best workable view, in my opinion, of language for safeguarding and documenting programs is one view which starts from the language community and their own agendas. At the same time, I maintain effective safeguarding and documentation, and that is one that does not see languages as objects of study detached from speakers, can only be based on the idea that language promotion is part of the promotion of speakers' social, economical, and cultural rights. And this is clearly seen by the Indian movement. So they say, we have the right to speak our own language, but also we have the right to live in a certain or a specific habitat or territory. We have the right to have our own legal system, etc., etc. And that is closely interconnected. So they seek to promote language not by itself, the Indian nations in Ecuador, they seek not to promote language not by itself, but always in connection with respect of their ancestral territories, their natural resources, and other constitutionally defined rights, such as those to their education, their own system of justice, their own knowledge systems, and their own idea of property. And this is one of the last things I would like to talk about. Property, certainly property is a very sensitive concept in the area of documentation and in the area of revitalization, and also, why not, in the area of oral tradition. We have discussed this clash, for instance, yesterday between the individual property rights and the collective property rights. So, it's necessary to know first that when we are making documentation and we're making revitalization programs and so on, it's necessary first to know if the knowledge documented through language is viewed as an individual or a collective property. And that should be done from the very, very beginning. And in some cases, it's necessary to consult the whole group or its leaders, not only the speakers themselves, about the property rights of what is being or is to be documented. This is this reflection is the result of my last 3 years of working with indigenous languages in Ecuador. I have begun with the idea precisely this, I would say, this Western idea of individual property. But then, on the way, I have realized that it's necessary to talk about property with the Indian groups, with the people being being documented in the very beginning. This cannot be left to the end. So this is what I have found very helpful. So now, yeah, summing up, I think that language as cultural heritage is an ambiguous concept that veils different political stances and interests. Language can be safeguarded efficiently only if viewed as part of a group's cultural heritage, not the nation's, not the humankind's. Language revitalization should be tightly linked to the holistic promotion of social, economic, and cultural rights. At least that is the stance taken by Indian nations in Ecuador, and something that we have to take into account for any revitalization or documentation program. Only in this context, the relevance of intercultural bilingual education for the state can be understood. So we cannot just think of intercultural bilingual education as simply an opportunity that the state gives to Indian peoples to be educated in their own languages. No, it's a part of a bigger thing. It's part of their claiming their own rights to education, to territory, to justice, whatever. So, similarly, when giving priority to the writing of indigenous languages, like so far has given by the intercultural bilingual education itself, we are disregarding the people's main view of them as vehicles of everyday interaction. And as we have seen, the background for the writing of indigenous languages is not set yet. And finally, I should just repeat what I had said before, the concept of property should be discussed first among speakers, leaders, and the speech community as a whole, proceeding to documentation and archiving. That's it. Oh, by the way, this is a photo of the really last three speakers of a language declared dead by some SIL linguist in 1993. Okay.